You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Second City is back open for live shows, in-person classes, and customized corporate workshops and performances. But we also have all those things available in virtual formats. You can go online and find out all the information you need at secondcity.com. Today's podcast is with Jen Lim, who is the co-founder and CEO of Delivering Happiness. And you probably know them from their association with Zappos and her partner, the late Tony Hsieh. Her new book is called Beyond Happiness, How Authentic Leaders Prioritize Purpose and People for Growth and Impact. It's a pretty powerful conversation. I hope you enjoy it. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Jen Lim, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Honored to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here. I love this book. And it is a book. It's a business book, but it's more than that. And it's born of loss. I think that's important to address because it really informs, quite frankly, what I think is a very positive pro-social outlook, but coming out of a lot of pain. And that's when you lost your friend, Tony Hsieh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you saw that because it was bought as a business book. It was supposed to be for the publisher, and then 2020 happened, and then all the sequence of events for everyone in the world, you know, and then everyone had a sense of loss and grief. And I just tried to process and capture it all. So thank you for pointing that out.
And you say in the book, quote, Tony's death with the heavy media storm and cynical, at times heartless questions was testing all the lessons I'd learned about highs, lows, happiness, and beyond. Did you find yourself going through the stages? I mean, I know for me, the grief journey, you want to be linear, and it just isn't. And it's quite frankly never over. And I'm wondering if that seems to me that's what you experienced as well.
Exactly. Because, you know, the whole time heals all wounds thing is like kind of bull crap to me. Because like I lost my dad 18 years ago. He was way too young. Mm-hmm. I was in my late 20s. And then of course with Tony's passing, it just brought it back to a different level of like, you know, now that we're a bit more mature and more self-aware in who we are and what we are doing in life. But yeah, I mean, it just came full circle, but in such a deeper way that I needed to really get into that grief process that I hadn't before, especially because I'm, you know, known for happiness. So right. I had to call it upon myself and question, like, you know, if am I still a believer of all these things? And with all that we as a global society experienced during the last 18 plus months now, then I put that to the test and did not know that Tony was going to pass. And I came through it and still processing, of course, but, and launching this book and really wanting to share that it is, you know, the cliche is true that unless we really understand our lows and actually mm-hmm. accept them and embrace them and not put, you know, sweep them under the rug, we won't, we really won't understand our highs.
the quote that keeps coming back to me that my therapist first said to me and then someone else said to me is a Ram Dass quote that we're all just walking each other home. And I find that to be lovely. And then a bit depressing when you move from the personal to the sort of the world events, because you write in the book, quote, historically, sharing a common enemy is one of the best ways to bring people together. Before 2020, I would have considered global pandemic to be a pretty safe bet to be that enemy. Instead, it just revealed how fractured we were. So this is just, this is this bizarre place where we find ourselves that we can't ignore. Business people can't ignore because it's a human problem and humans work in business.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. I mean, it just in that sense of everything got flattened between, you know, businesses of CEOs, board members to the frontliners of what really not just happiness means, but what humanity means. And this was a global, as we all know, like the reset on humanity was hit on a global scale. So what better time than now to look on the, you know, the silver lining of it all to reflect in that. And I think that's been one of the most promising thing that people and, you know, people that are leading companies can see that. And we need more of that humanity at work.
I was thrilled that you had this little data point in this book because I interviewed Ray Wang for the podcast and he had also this data point in his book, but the audio was so bad we couldn't air it. You talk about that it took 75 years for the telephone to reach 50 million people in the world. And it only took 19 days to reach the same number of people in 2016 through Pokemon Go. So yeah. That is ridiculous, terrifying, and impressive all at the same time.
1,000% agreed. I think like I brought that one data point up because it's just like, that's just one of so many exponential things that are happening that we're not even aware of unless, and sometimes, you know, until we sit with it and understand the rate of exponential change is outpassing our ability as humans to adapt. So therefore, that's why I think this, like, we're really digging deep into being into ourselves and understanding that.
And you write about the fact that we're living in this adaptive age. And I really love this sort of very simple thing you say in the book, which is, quote, control and change what we can, embrace and adapt to what we can't. It's simple, it's hard. But I think in its simplicity, it makes a lot of sense. You know, we can't control certain things, but as human beings, we do have the ability to control how we perceive it. And in that, that's where problem solving, I think, starts.
Yeah, totally. Like, that's one of the biggest things I've been learning even before the pandemic. And I, you know, I've been doing this delivering happiness stuff for 11 years now, and even before that at Zappos. But like, we were always based on scientific happiness, and we've seen it evolve over the years. But then over the more recent years, there's such a large basis of the biggest change that can happen is within our own sense of control. And when I say control, we can, the biggest things that we can control is like who we are, like purpose, values. And I know I talk about this book or in that in the book quite a bit, but it really becomes that pillar that will never, like, no matter what sandstorm is out there, no matter what earthquake goes on, we are, if we ground ourselves in that, then that will never change. And I've seen that's the biggest change and shift that just got amplified, you know, since 2020.
Which is the reason we need to double down on our human beings. I was saying this to, we have a new sort of head of HR, and I was saying to her, I do a lot of talks for HR organizations. I think that in the future, that's going to be the most powerful department in any organization, because they're going to be about instilling peak performance. And what we know about that is mm-hmm. that the incentives are wrong in business. And this goes back to the educational system that's not set up based on contemporary science. You know, it's still factory systems. And a lot of our workplaces mm-hmm. are like that. But people are more evolved. And you say a really lovely thing in here about that companies are basically people making choices. It's so much easier to think that you don't have any control when you think of the monolith, but the monolith is just a bunch of us.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah. And I love that you bring that up because there is there's the sense of autonomy that we, in the end of the day, have our sense of control of what we, the decisions we make. But there's also been a very promising future, because we've been hearing about like the future work, yada, 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 all the for so long. Future work just got slapped in our face, like because of all that happened. And we're living that future work now. What I feel so promised and uplifted about, even though we're still in the middle of it, is that there's more and more leaders that are understanding that from a business level, that can't be just treated as like, you know, the so-called worker or employee. You got to be treated as human beings. And I've seen it with one of our clients, Starbucks. I've seen it with other examples of people that are companies that are investing in reskilling people to be beyond automation, because there are certain things that, you know, AI, AR will never do, at least that we know of now. And, you know, being creative, having that emotive feeling and like giving a colleague a high five or hello in a meaningful way. So those things are very promising to me, but it has to be a constant everyday reminder for all of us as leaders in our own life and leaders of companies.
Yeah, robots can't improvise and they're not funny. So that's another two things that we could check off of that. So let's talk a bit about the greenhouse model, because this is where you sort of dig into. And what I want to do is talk very practically, because I think you do it in the book. When you throw around terms like purpose or values, you're actually talking about the way they play out in our day-to-day actions. So let's start with purpose, which you say is the most sustainable form of happiness.
Yeah. So that basis goes back to scientific happiness, goes back to Aristotle. Like back in the day, he said, happiness is the purpose of our existence. And most importantly, happiness is dependent on ourselves. So what we've seen, especially in positive psychology and the latest research in a couple of decades, is that still holds true. And so this is not a new concept by any means, and nor is it rocket science. But what I've seen happen, especially in the last 10 years, is that when we put that into place and actually make it livable, so people are actually showing up to work and feel that they're living their own personal purpose that's aligned with their company's purpose. And we see it more and more companies like being bold with their claims of what their purposes are, like Airbnb, even Tesla, like, you know, Patagonia is like a poster child of all this stuff. But the biggest part of that is like when we can actually express our purpose and values in the workplace. And we have leaders, whether it's a team, and even if the CEO doesn't get it, that's fine, because we all have control within our own realm of what we want to do. Once we see that alignment of who we are, as we define it for ourselves, and this is like totally how we define happiness for ourselves, once we align that foundationally in us, and then therefore align it with that of the company and teams, that's when we see the most positive change happen, especially when we have no idea what's going to happen the next day. These days.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been thinking a lot that we're not going to solve these problems person by person, and we're not going to solve them company by company, but I think we could solve them team by team. And we just had a couple people on about burnout, and the Mayo Clinic, their most recent studies is that the way you treat burnout most effectively is at a team level, not an individual level, that which surprised me, not when I thought about it a little bit. But then that the thing I think that's crucially missing inside of a lot of teams is really talking to each other and knowing what everyone's going through. You know, I think this idea, an idea that's been discussed on this podcast, is before a meeting, everyone talk about a thing that's where they're stuck or where they're having a problem or where they have a pain. And then that opens up a whole area of what I think we mean when we say authenticity, which is not like you can, you know, come in a clown suit. I mean, if you're into it, whatever, it depends on your company, but that at least what you know is that you can come in and be real, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That's the real talk that I think everyone is craving and needing at this time. And I love the fact that you bring up the team aspect, because it's really why I wanted to break out the book in terms of our frameworks between the me, we community, and it taps back into what we can control. So the teams that we are working in on a day-to-day basis, we have a greater sense of control what we can do there. And I see teams like as a maybe an easier way to think about it, knowing that villages and humanity has lasted through time through this concept of villages. People have roles. They're here to support each other. You know, if someone's not doing something, someone else will come in and help that other person. I think teams and, you know, laddering up to organizations are modern day villages. Mm-hmm. People are so thirsty and needing social connection. And that's, you know, neuroscientific, that's biological, it's physiological. And so I think that's the greatest sort of short term and midterm, long term impact we can make by controlling those conditions of what we can do, introducing the concepts of what are our team's values? Like, even if my COO doesn't give a crap about this, let's develop for ourselves. What's our team's purpose? Making it higher than making more money. When you start doing those things, that's when the village forms and you see people just looking out for each other.
Even one layer below that, there's some studies I've seen that suggest that our teaming evolved as caregivers. So men and women caring for the children that they, and that those jobs were done together until, you know, things changed. And given what's going on in Washington today and these proposals and just the overwhelming need for our country to start to recognize that without support for caregiving, we are lost. Like, and it is again, it's one of these things that the science tells us these things, but also the reality of two people, we live in a place where the wife and the husband have to work. Mm-hmm. And if they've got kids, like it can't all fall on the woman. And you know, so I think, and you say in the book too, that 10 or 20 years ago, hearing words like vulnerability, resilience, compassion, and mindfulness and love at work was a huge rarity. Mm-hmm. I'd add care to that, but because I think they all apply, especially in places of work that want to thrive.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree. And thank you for putting another four-letter word in there because, okay. Yeah, it's, I mean, for me, that's where I see the light, you know, like the light of the tunnel of seeing like that there is more of an awakening of self-awareness of what we need as individuals. And from a leadership perspective, whether C-level or board members, like we need to get people, like they're our assets. If we actually invest in them, they'll make us more money, we'll lose less mm-hmm. money kind of thing. That's one of the big points I wanted to make in tying those things together. And on the caregiver front, I think it's hugely important. And one of the metaphors I try to introduce in a deeper way is that as leaders and caregivers, we all want to help nurture and grow others. So a big point in the book I wanted to make was like, make sure you're nurturing your greenhouse first.
Yeah.
The whole oxygen mask in an airplane. I know we haven't heard it in a long time because we're not flying anymore, but you know what I'm saying? Like nurture mm-hmm. your greenhouse as you nurture others. Cause we have the natural tendency to want to do that. And only you know how to nurture your own and being more vulnerable to that within yourself and being more gentle and patient with that conversation. I mean, I don't know if self-love are two, another four letter words that we don't want to talk mm-hmm. about, but it's so, I mean, I just got off a webinar with Peter Diamandis yesterday, like, you know, futurist and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And we spent time on self-love because someone asked from his community, abundance community, like, how do you do that? So I think the fact that we're talking about these things is a huge step in the right direction.
Yep. That's the first step.
Opening up that conversation, mm-hmm. not feeling pain or not feeling shame in saying that, look, I'm tired or I cannot do this. I mean, Simone Biles did it on an international stage. So, and that's her workplace, but we all have our own workplace and our own families and our lives. So it's time that let's keep on growing that space, safe space for that conversation would be awesome.
I co-led an interactive keynote workshop today for this global law firm, and we were sort of prepped that they're kind of hard-nosed lawyers, and so I set up this whole thing where I was going to prove that, like before I got into my improv stuff, I was going to prove to them that this had real value and it was based on real facts and real science. And then the person who was before us was this mindfulness expert doing breathing exercises. And I'm like, oh, wait, I'm like, if they're starting with this, I'm going to be fine. and the guy afterward that head of the company was like, oh yeah, no, I mean the breathing, the exhaling is hugely important. I'm like, I know, but people don't talk about that. I can't believe you are talking about that work. That's fantastic. So,
yeah,
you know, it's some stuff is starting to evolve, I think.
It totally is. And sometimes I feel the same way. Like, it's crazy town. I don't have to, you know, we don't have to twist anyone's arms anymore to be talking about this. It's actually more embraced. We did. Yeah. Not even that long ago.
No, six years.
Yeah. Ago? I would say when we launched Delivering Happiness was 2010. And that was like, oh yeah, that's cute. That's novel. Yes.
Yeah. We talk a lot about storytelling on this podcast, and I find that people mean something different when they say storytelling a lot. So I'm curious to have you break down a little bit. When you say in the book, quote, ultimately, we're made of the stories we live. Tell me what you mean by that.
First off, thank you for reading the book. You're amazing in your questions. I'm like, damn, he really dug into it. That's awesome. What I meant by that is that unless we actually reflect and call out what we're living on a day-to-day basis, and whether it's writing or narrative or, you know, talking to a friend, articulating in a blog, you know, whatever form of expression, if we're not capturing and expressing it in some way, then the stories, I mean, will just go in a way that we're not really truly ingesting them, nor are we spreading it in a way that like is expressive of who we are as a human being. So that's what I mean by it. It's like, while we live in every day, if we're not reflecting, and of course, you know, coming from a positivity standpoint, like showing gratitude in those stories, and also acknowledging the pains that you, you know, kicked off this whole conversation with, then we're not really living it in a way that's embedded within ourselves, number one, from a psyche and physiological standpoint and neuroscientific, but also with the people that we love. I mean, they connect to these things in ways that we don't know, because we don't know the pain they're going through or the joy until, like, let's be the leaders of that. Let's just call it out with our own stories.
That's probably been the hardest thing. That was initially the hardest thing. My wife and I lost our daughter to cancer 2 years ago. And so it was very public. And I work at a comedy theater, and so does Anne, and my wife. And one of the things that we realized as we sort of dug in on the grief journey and the sort of the journey back to ourselves in whatever regard was, so many people shared with us the unbelievable pain that they're going through in their lives that they had not spoken out loud. Mm-hmm. And I have the gift of being, you know, I'm an older straight white male with a whole bunch of privilege in my community and public figure. And so when I shared it, people are like, oh, that's so great. But other people aren't allowed to, or don't think they're allowed to. Mm-hmm. And what I realized too, is that I couldn't embrace the happiness without first embracing all the darkness and the grief. And that runs through this book. That's why I think I was so moved by it, because it is a business book. You have exercises and you have real stuff that you're talking about for people to do on a day-to-day basis. But at the same time, your pain you can see in the pages. Mm-hmm. And you can also see you're still not giving up on the other side too, because we don't have one without the other. That's the tough thing here, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I'm so sorry to hear that of what you experienced and your wife. But what you're bringing up is exactly the, you know, one of the reasons why it's a business book for sure. I want to make it practical and make sure like companies know you can care about people, be positive, and actually be more profitable in the end. But really what we're tapping into and what you just shared is that we're tapping into a core of humanity and humanness. And we can talk about happiness all day, but until we can actually feel confident enough to say we can share these, like I really would love for this next quote unquote chapter for people to be more open about sharing the dark side, the depths of pain and grief that we go through, and those jagged edges that I talk about that do, as we know, and you've gone through this for the last 2 years, can reflect and go and say, wow, you know, I went through that and I can go through something else again and build that resilience. And it's freaking hard as hell.
Yeah.
But it's just so embedded in part of our lives. And so that's why a big piece of it was just, it was a deep processing of Tony's passing. It was a deep nod to everything I believed in. It just like, I'm not trying to, or we shouldn't be working for our resume. We should be working for our eulogy, because we just never know what's going to happen. And what do we want to be known for within ourselves, number one, and for the people that we love when that time comes?
We had on the podcast a while ago, Valerie Kaur, who wrote a lovely book called See No Stranger. And she's a Sikh activist and lawyer and filmmaker. And she sort of has this idea around radical love, and in terms of even people who have hurt her, attempting to try to come around to that. And I really love, you say this at the end of the book, you go, quote, "If I could choose a superpower, it'd be the ability to sit down with everyone in the world until they know I see the light in them." I mean, that's a very, you know, that's a very powerful sentiment that puts a lot of onus on you. But also I think what it then reflects is that, you know, that that's going to come back to you.
I didn't think about the latter part of the coming back, but I do know that that's what keeps me going.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Yeah. A couple more questions before I ask you for your yes and story. You say that the most common fail, is this you? Yeah, I think it is. Is the most common fail factor that you've seen is, quote, a lack of clearly defined desired behaviors?
Yeah.
Okay. I love that, because I feel like it may seem silly, but like, we're working on some of the stuff at Second City right now, as we're sort of rebuilding. And like, we should put down our, like, the kinds of behavior. I mean, we talk about it in improv all the time, but we should talk about it for our business in terms of like, not just showing up on time, though that's a big one for me, but also that, you know, you're respectful and that you listen and that you don't interrupt. It's that clear, right?
It is. And it seems so basic, but unless it's codified, unless it's written, and unless it's all aligned and everyone, we actually say, just literally sign off on it in a way, like, even new people coming to Second City, new people coming to organizations, give them this piece of paper, say, you're going to sign off on this. And if you're not living by these behaviors, then this is not going to be a good culture fit. You know, biggest poster child on the other side of the bad end of Enron, like, number one code, I mean, sorry, value for them was integrity, and their behaviors did not exhibit that by any means. Like, integrity does not mean squandering billions of dollars from the people that you're serving. So all that, but yeah, it's that simple. Just going that extra step, because we see values of like, oh, communication, oh, responsibility, accountability. But what does that really mean? And then when you actually have what we're doing right now, like organizations and teams like ours, we're signing social contracts with the people that we're a part of. And when we actually, whether literally or, you know, behaviorally sign them, and actually have people accountable for them. So it's basically like, anyone can call each other out, even as like the leader of your team, someone can call you out and say, you know what, you didn't really or do that. So,
you don't write the book Yes And without just setting yourself up for a life of hurt when you say no. And that's fine. That's fine. Yeah. I mean, and actually in the context of a little bit of humor, it's easier to take, but it is impossible to think that we're all going to sort of behave well 24/7. And we should rely on each other to keep us in check. And my friend Kim Scott, who wrote the book Radical Candor, has a great thing. Like you can do radical candor with me if I know you love me. And that's fine. That's the state we should be in. If we care about each other.
Yeah. And that's where the values to behaviors identify and codify help it immensely, because have these conversations, but unless people are like aware, communicated with, and accountable for it, then it's going to be super hard.
I also love how you talk about DEIB in the book. You say, quote, "Diversity is being asked to the dance. Inclusion is being asked to dance. Belonging is being able to dance how you want. And equity is to have a turn to pick the DJ." That's a nice way of sort of saying, like, this is what we're trying to say. This is what we're talking about as our workplaces become well more diverse than black and white. Well more diverse. I mean, there's neurodiversity. There's economic diversity. There's all that other stuff that our need to understand the nuances within how different people get to play. Or have traditionally gotten to play, and who's traditionally not been able to play, is hugely important for our day-to-day success.
Totally. Yeah. And I try to do different people have different variations of it. I just try to do like the Friday night version of it because I think people can remember it better. Mm-hmm. But I think it's just for us as teams and organizations to just identify and be clear of what we mean. What do we mean by D&I? What do we mean by culture? You know, what do we mean by sustainability, which is like a bigger question that was prompted, you know, 10, 15 years ago. But I think the more we can be specific about these definitions and where we stand, because everyone's drawing a line in the sand more than ever of like, if it's banned, like the fact that we're not happy with the voting rights in Texas or Georgia, like huge companies like Coca-Cola mm-hmm. and Citi are like, they're saying, oh, well, we're not going to stand for that. That's pretty crazy. That didn't happen just like 3 years ago. So I think for us as leaders, we should be super clear and, if anything, over communicative about where we stand on these things.
So we always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. In the parlance of improvisation, when two people are making something out of nothing, they get nowhere by saying no. They actually don't get that far by saying yes. We say, you say yes and you affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. Do you have a yes and story for us?
I do. And this one was and you brought it up at the very beginning of this. And like, I love that you just deep dove into, cause you've known, you and Second City have known Tony from the past. Yep. I think that's a beautiful story. So I thought I would share mine on the yes and part of this. Cause, after he passed, it was COVID still is. And, you know, there's no in-person funeral service for all of, you know, everything, friends, et cetera, family. And then some friend said, hey, we're going to do something different. And we're just going to do something online and ask everyone to contribute in their own way. And it spanned from Bill Clinton to, you know, some band in Chicago to some, you know, amazing artists in Vegas. And I was like, hell no. Like, who am I to contribute to this basically celebration of art and expression for his passing? Cause I just really just clammed up because I didn't even know what to express at that point. Yeah. But I sat with the idea for a bit. And it's actually Penn's wife, Emily. She was the one that's just like, no pressure, just let me know. And I sat with it and I just like, you know, what is this for? And it's for my, like, something I couldn't even write about at that time. I couldn't even express in any way. And I said, you know, okay, I'm going to say yes. And I had prior to his passing, I had bought a, electric piano because, you know, we had time mm-hmm. and piano used to be a chore because I'm Asian American because it was a requirement in life.
Yes.
And then I bought a piano because like, I want to enjoy it again. And then at that point I said yes. And to, you know, I heard a song and it just resonated with me and I decided to add some notes to it and play along. And I was like super nervous, super like, I don't even know if this is going to work because I'm not that kind of impromptu kind of person, mm-hmm. especially on the piano.
Yeah.
Because I'm classically trained and all that crap. Right. And, you know, and this went live during the event for Tony. It was almost a year ago in December for his birthday. And that, I think I was... it just, when you ask that question, that's what resonated with me most. Cause I was freaked out cause I didn't know how to express, but somehow it came out and people were chatting in the, you know, in the mm-hmm. event and saying, I didn't know you know how to play piano, Dan. And I was like, yeah, I didn't know. And just like, yeah, it opened up a different space of feelings and conversation that within me and the people that Tony and I knew, so yeah, that was my yes and moment.
Was it an instrumental piece?
It was, yeah. It's like it was an instrumental piece and it had some like it's a little bit electronica style and it had some like mm-hmm. recordings of you know like, I think it sounds like from the 50s of some gentleman talking about the meaning of life and all that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, I mean, words sometimes don't work. And so, you know, and sometimes to do it, poetry was obviously a huge thing for me in the last few years. But music still is something that, you know, reaches us in different ways. I'm going to my first indoor concert tonight.
Oh, whoa. Who is it?
It's a group called Jukebox the Ghost. They actually are our intro and exit music on the podcast. They are, I like to say, Queen meets Ben Folds.
Wow.
So yeah, Ben Thornwell, who's the lead singer, has the range of Freddie Mercury, but they write these catchy little pop numbers that some are, get very dramatic at times.
Oh, so, dang.
Yeah. So I'm excited about that. And so sort of embrace that. I loved your story. The book is called Beyond Happiness. Jen Lim, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, Kelly. Have fun tonight.
I will.
Getting to Yes And is produced by The Second City, Second City Works, and WGN Radio. It's also produced by Elif Garris, with help by Mike Farinacchio and Colleen Fahey. The music that you hear that intros and outros the program is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you want to get more information on The Second City, you can reach us at www.secondcityworks.com or email us at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.